Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Kirchick, who's a journalist and foreign correspondent who has reported from Southern and North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent and the Caucasus. He's a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. And his latest book just out is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. And he has an op-ed at Politico, How the GOP Became the Party of Putin. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Kirchick.
Thank you for having me.
And the subtitle to your article at Politico, James Kirchick, is Republicans Have Sold Their Souls to Russia and Trump Isn't the Only Reason Why. What is going on here? Because the people that normally were the red baiters during the McCarthy era, the communist haters during the Cold War, it was pretty clear where they stood. And paradoxically, of course, the Soviets actually preferred to deal with Republicans. They didn't quite trust Democrats in terms of foreign policy, but nevertheless, the record is pretty clear on that. So now you have the former hawks making excuses for Putin on the right, and then on the left, you've got people like Oliver Stone doing a four-hour Valentine for a Putin on Showtime. So it's pretty topsy-turvy, isn't it?
Yeah, on the right, there's several things. One, I mean, Russia is no longer the communist, atheistic, you know, godless empire that it was. And so for religious conservatives who didn't like the fact that the Soviet Union was atheistic, there's that issue is no longer there. And Putin has actually been very good at trying to portray himself and his regime as being sort of this last bastion of Christianity. And that's taken hold among some on the right. There's also just the sheer opportunism in the fact that, you know, Donald Trump, for reasons that are still mysterious, has this affinity for Putin, and he was the nominee, and so Republicans are just going to get in line behind the man who is now the president. But in the article that I wrote, I think there's something deeper going on, which is really that the conservative movement, such as it is, particularly under the Obama years, really just became a kind of outrage industry. And you can see that in the book publishers and the radio hosts and a certain television network. A lot of money is made in sort of peddling resentment in this country. And there really aren't many ideas. And so I think the notion of sort of principled opposition to a dictatorship or a regime that is causing all this, you know, problems in our own electoral system by hacking the Democrats, that just wasn't there anymore. And it made the conservative movement, I think, quite susceptible to manipulation because they don't really have principles and they don't really stand for the things that they did, at least when Ronald Reagan was president.
Well, I suppose, in a way, you're describing Dana Rohrabeck out here in California. It's completely mystifying what's going on there. Yeah. I know at that meeting Kevin McCarthy, a very select group of the top House Republicans, with Paul Ryan, McCarthy sort of said, you know, swear to God, you know, Dana Rohrabeck and Trump are on Putin's payroll or something. I'm paraphrasing what they said. And, you know, that actually happened. And the guy that ran as an independent on the Republican side, Evan McMullen, was in that meeting and has verified it. So it definitely happened. And then immediately Ryan said, let's not talk about that. that's pretty amazing, isn't it? If the number two guy in the House on the Republican side has that, you know, more than a suspicion, but, you know, so he says swear to God. I mean, what did you make of
that? Well, I don't know. I mean, if there was evidence of that, I think we would. I mean, if it's true, I think we should investigate it. I mean, if he's taking money from a foreign government, that's probably illegal. Dana Rohrabacher has always been kind of an odd duck, although his transformation has been really one of the more remarkable ones. I mean, this was a man who actually went to Afghanistan to fight the Russians with Mujahideen. And he worked as a speechwriter for Ronald Reagan. And over the past couple of years, he's been one of, if not the most outspoken defender of Vladimir Putin in the U.S. Congress. I think for him, part of it is explained by this very effective narrative that the Russians have been putting out for quite a while now, which is that they are allies in the struggle against Islam. Or Islamic terrorism, if you will, and that there's a civilizational war going on, and that whatever differences we might have with Russia on, you know, little things like invading and annexing Ukraine, at the end of the day, we're all basically, you know, Christian members of this Judeo-Christian civilization that's struggling against the Muslim hordes. And I think that's, if you listen to Dana Rocker, that's basically the line that he's taking. That's the line that other people are taking, like Franklin Graham. And I think a lot of people on the religious right are attracted to this. It's complete nonsense. The Russians are, I mean, their way of fighting Islamic terrorism is to basically level entire cities. You can just look at what they did in Chechnya, killing tens of thousands of innocent people, women and children. And as far as, you know, Syria goes, which is where this argument is really being operationalized, that we should be allies with Russia in fighting ISIS, ISIS is not really the target of Russia's military effort in Syria. They're mainly trying to defend the Assad regime, and they're mostly attacking the nationalist rebels who are fighting him. They're not fighting ISIS. So this is there's really nothing to this argument, but unfortunately a lot of people, not only in America, but in Europe, on the political right, are susceptible to it.
And again, I'm speaking with James Kirchick, who's a journalist and foreign correspondent, who has reported from Southern and North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent, and the Caucasus. He is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., a correspondent for The Daily Beast, and a columnist for Tablet. And his latest book just out is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. And he has an op-ed at Politico, How the GOP Became the Party of Putin. So in your article, of course, you cite the recent polls that say 48% of Republicans think Donald Jr. was right to take the meeting with the Russian lawyer who is rumored to have intelligence ties. Certainly the other Russian that came in with her definitely has a background in Soviet military counterintelligence. There was a translator there. Nobody's been able to talk to him. But what was released in that email chain was pretty damning, was it not? And now we know that the Crown Prosecutor they're referring to is a specialist in setting up, you know, honey trap type videos. That's how Putin rose to power, was the prosecutor was looking into corruption in the Yeltsin administration, and Putin, through this fellow Chika, was able to set up a honey trap video, which may not have even been the prosecutor in it. He swears he wasn't in the video, but they played it all over state TV, and they even had the hookers come in and talk about it. And that, of course, destroyed this guy and so forth. So just on the surface, you have to ask yourself, what are these people doing talking to these sleazy, murderous people with so much blood on their hands, including Magnitsky's?
I think it just shows you the complete and utter unscrupulousness, the lack of patriotism of the Trump clan. The fact that their first impulse upon being contacted by someone claiming to have information working for the Russian government, and that they're trying to sabotage the U.S. presidential election, the first reaction of any patriotic American, I don't care if you're a Republican or conservative who doesn't like Hillary Clinton, the first thing you do is you call the FBI. You don't write back, oh, this is wonderful, let's see the information. And I don't think that the notion of even calling the FBI never even entered Donald Trump's head. And this is why I say in the piece that I think the Russians really read the situation very well. They could tell that people like Donald Trump, the people around him, many people in the Republican Party, despite their claims of being patriots and God-fearing Americans, at the end of the day, would be willing to work with avowed enemies of this country, the Russian KGB, as long as they could use that to defeat Hillary Clinton. At the end of the day, they hate Hillary Clinton more than they do Vladimir Putin. And that, to me, is just, you know, I can't abide that. I can't understand that. I can't defend it. I'm not sure if anything that Donald Trump Jr. did was necessarily illegal. We don't really know what went on in that meeting. I think, at the very least, we have an intent to collude with Russia, but I don't think we have evidence yet of actual criminal activity.
Right, but it's reasonable to assume that the meeting itself, the fact that it took place, could have been seen as a, you know, an opening gambit. I mean, the fact that they took the meeting in itself is sufficiently incriminating. So maybe the Russians were basically...
Well, it's morally incriminating. I'm not sure. I mean, again, this is all being investigated by Robert Mueller, as it should be. But I'm hesitant to make accusations that have legal force, unless we see all the evidence. I mean, I definitely, like I said, I think I think I spoke to you a month or two ago, and I said, you know, we may find out that the Trumps are guilty of nothing more than being unscrupulous and unpatriotic, and that there's no laws against what they did. And maybe we need to come up with new laws, okay? Maybe we need to devise certain regulations about the ways in which foreigners can involve themselves in our political campaigns. I haven't seen evidence yet of illegal activity, and I'm not defending the Trumps when I'm saying this. I think that they're completely disgusting in the way that they've behaved, and as are many of the people defending them. But just from a legal standpoint, I think I have not seen the evidence yet of illegal behavior.
Well, there is an area, though, where it seems that the Trump campaign, and particularly Stephen Bannon, have borrowed from the playbook of Surkoff, who was a theater director who became Putin's kind of media guru. And there's no question that Surkoff's idea of via Putin and via Putin's control of the media in Russia to spread this idea, and of course they do it in English through their English language network, RT and Sputnik, to sort of instill in the public through sort of chaos and contradiction the notion that there's no such thing anymore as objective truth, that the truth is subjective. And that has been extremely effective, and that explains how Trump has about, 35% at least of the American people simply believing anything that he says and not believing a thing that the mainstream press, which they call fake news, puts out. That in itself is an extraordinary achievement. And here he is just yesterday, Trump, talking about all the amazing bills that he's passed and how he surpassed FDR and Harry Truman in getting stuff done. And none of it's true. But that doesn't mean that his people don't believe it. So is there a connection there? In not just necessarily a physical connection, but at least an intellectual connection.
It might be giving Trump and Bannon a little too much credit to think that they are aware of Surkoff and his methods. It might be. I'm not sure. I'd be interested to ask Steve Bannon this if I ever had the chance to interview him. But I definitely agree with your analysis that it's a completely cynical attempt to basically destroy the notion of objective truth. And I have a friend, Peter Pomerantsev, who wrote an excellent book about Russia called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. And he wrote that book several years ago before the prospect of Donald Trump even becoming, you know, president was on anyone's mind. And I think if you go back and read that book today, it's very eerie. He wrote about Russia, but the ways in which it could be applied to the United States is very creepy. And I think you're absolutely right in sort of destroying public trust in institutions, in the news media. I mean, this is from the toolkit of authoritarians. Because once there is no truth, or once the traditional outlets are responsible for covering government and life and the news media, which is supposed to be an independent arbiter of these things, once people no longer trust it, then it does make it a lot easier for a demagogic leader like Donald Trump to convince people that what he's doing is right.
Well, I recently spoke with David Rothkopf, who was formerly the head of foreign policy and now a columnist at the Washington Post. And he had a piece recently in the Washington Post that posited the notion that the greatest threat to U.S. national security is the president of the United States himself. What's your sense in that regard? Because we can't still figure out why he goes out of his way to make excuses for Putin and then trashes allies like Angela Merkel and hangs up on the Australian Prime Minister, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a fundamental puzzlement that's been there from day one. And what's your sense of, is it that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter that Putin meddled in the elections one way or the other, or colluded if indeed he did? At the end of the day, he's gotten what he wants, which is this man in the Oval Office is weakening America at warp speed.
Yeah. Well, I said from the very beginning that the reason why the Russians wanted Trump was not in particular for any policy decisions. Trump may lighten up the pressure on sanctions on Ukraine. They're all a bunch of, you know, just discrete specific policy issues, the Magnitsky sanctions, all these things. I think that's kind of small ball. I think looking at the broader picture, the reason why the Russians wanted Trump is because they wanted to discredit the United States as the leader of the free world. And it's hard for me to think of someone, of anyone, who more discredits the United States' traditional leadership position than Donald Trump. He makes it incredibly difficult for pro-American political leaders around the world to operate because he's toxic, and he helps anti-American political figures around the world. Just having Donald Trump in office in that sense is a real tragedy and a real problem. And I think Putin loves to be able to point at the West and say, oh, democracy, it's all a sham, he's better than us. This whole moral relativeness that he's been promoting for years. And I think Trump makes that mission a lot easier. Because it's a lot easier to say the West is just a bunch of, you know, bankers stealing money from the poor and all these other horrible things. If you can point at Donald Trump, who's president of the United States. So I think that's why the Russians did what they did.
Well, just in closing then, there has been a slight weakening of this kind of firewall of the core support in those that believe in Kellyanne Conway's alternative facts, the core support for Trump. And there was recently a poll from ABC and the Washington Post that had 89% of Trump's voters believing that he was honest and trustworthy and would fulfill his promises. And at this, by 78% margin, I believe they thought that the mainstream media basically propagates fake news. So that is his hermetically sealed world. But it seems to be being chipped away with. A recent poll following the Donald Jr. Trump Tower meeting with the Russians seems to have eroded that a little. So what do you think can be done to reach these people to understand that this is a really bad situation to having this man, you know, he's a danger to America's national security if you accept David Rothkopf's thesis?
Yeah. I think he's been able to skate by because there hasn't really been a major foreign policy crisis since he's been president. I think once that happens and he reacts impulsively as he's wont to do, I think I hope that the American people at that point would have a bit more, clarity in seeing what kind of man he is. But, you know, we're 8 or 9 months into the presidency so far, and there's been a lot of, you know, embarrassing moments. There's been a lot of summits that where he said silly things, where he's humiliated foreign leaders and whatnot, but that hasn't really been a crisis yet. And, you know, God forbid when that happens, as it inevitably will, I would expect the numbers of Americans who are seeing through Trump would increase.
Well, James Kirchick, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with James Kirchick, who's a journalist and foreign correspondent who has reported from southern North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent and the Caucasus. He is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and a correspondent for The Daily Beast and a columnist for Tablet. And his latest book just out is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. And he has an op-ed at Politico, How the GOP Became the Party of Putin. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back trying to make sense of the many tweets and statements coming from Donald Trump in the wake of the Republican Senate's latest failure to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act.